Well, good morning, and thank you again for coming out and taking a look at some things in the Bible that maybe we don't notice and we don't take a look at a whole lot in maybe a more traditional sermon or traditional lesson in church, but it's really because of my background studying wild things, wild places, studying animals, my background in biology, and my background in the church and studying the Bible, that I've made some connections. And that shouldn't really surprise us, because God only tells us about himself two ways. One is through his word and the Bible, and the other is through his creation. And these two things are in perfect sync. While most of the detractors of the Bible would want to argue that and always want to sort of pit science against the Bible, I've never found that to be the case. And what we've been looking at and what we're going to continue to look at this morning are some scientific concepts and some scientific facts that we know now today, because of study and technology and things like that, we're able to tell some of these things nowadays. And the whole premise of this, of my argument here, is that there are so many things said in the Bible that could not have been known by man during BC times. And of course, in our first sermon, we looked at the Dead Sea Scrolls. And what the Dead Sea Scrolls prove to us are really two major things. One, that the Bible that we have is old. The Dead Sea Scrolls are dated back to 200, 300 BC. So we know that our Old Testament is old. And two, we know that the Old Testament that was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls lines up perfectly with the modern translations of our Bible that we have today. So given the fact that that Old Testament was definitely written during BC times, when we open the Bible up and we see God repeatedly talking about the planet being a circle or a dome or a sphere, our planet hanging on nothing, our sun making an orbit or a circuit or a course, we see multiple times the water cycle described perfectly in the Old Testament. And all these things we really didn't understand until quite recent history. Now, I like to throw this question out to, especially when I'm teaching this to the younger kids. Because when I was young, I thought about this a lot. And I kind of struggled with it a little bit when I was quite young. Does the Bible mention dinosaurs? Why doesn't the Bible have the word dinosaur in it? We've got all these animals, and God's talking about all these things to Job. Why doesn't it say the word dinosaur? Dinosaur is kind of a new term, isn't it? It's something that we came up with in the late 1800s. We coined that word, terrible lizard or great lizard. So we'll see if the Bible talks about dinosaurs. And when I was a kid, I always thought, why doesn't the Bible talk about dinosaurs? Because we certainly can see the skeletal remains of these awesome creatures that used to roam this earth. We've got tangible physical proof. And when I was young, that kind of bothered me because, of course, I was enamored with animals and including dinosaurs. But as I grew and as I studied the Bible, I realized, oh, they're not absent from the Bible at all. God just may not use our words to describe these things. So these are some of the things that we're looking at today. So open your Bibles up to Job chapter 38, and we'll be in 39 very quickly. Let's see. Let me click this forward here. Okay, good. So in Job chapter 38, we remember the story that Job finally questioned God's treatment of him. And he said, he made the accusation to God that you have treated me unfairly. What you have done, I have served you and you have treated me unfairly. And Job had suffered tremendous loss. Lost all 10 of his children. Lost all of his wealth, his crops, all of his animals. Then even lost a portion of his health. God was allowing Satan to do these things, to test Job. And finally, Job cracked. And he called out God and he said, you are not treating me fairly. And so we read right here in Job chapter 38, it said, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? So we went through this yesterday afternoon, and we see some incredible things that God says here when he talks about the measurements of the earth, when he talks about how the stars sang, how he talked about, he asked Job, have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Do you know about the springs in the sea? Do you understand the constellations and how I have made the constellations and how I move the constellations? And so he says some incredible things that we have now come to understand scientifically. But my question always is, the Bible was either written by a man or it was written by God, as it claims it is. And if it was written by a man, how did the man during BC times know about recesses of the deep? How does he know about stars making sound? How does he know about springs in the sea? Can't know these things. A man just cannot know these things. So we worked our way all the way down to the last couple lines in this chapter. And in about, I think it's in verse 39, God shifts from talking about sort of some of the abiotic, natural things of this world. He shifts and he moves into the biotic things of this world. He starts talking about some of the living things that we have. And of course, we first mentioned the lion and then we talked about the raven last night. So let's turn our focus then to Job chapter 39. And we'll read some more information. This is a fun spot for me as a wildlife biologist, because here it is for about three chapters, just all wildlife. It's great. Let's read verse 1 through 4. Do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you count the months they fulfill? Or do you know the time they give birth? They kneel down, they bring forth their young. They get rid of their labor pains. Their offspring becomes strong. They grow up in the field. They leave and do not return to them. So God makes, I think another shift that God sort of makes right here too is in Job chapter 38, when he starts talking about, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you when I stretched the line or measured it? These are things that Job has probably rarely thought about. Things that he couldn't possibly measure or couldn't possibly see. He understands that they're there, but his knowledge of all those questions in Job chapter 38 are really, really limited. And God is just dropping these huge concepts on him at that point. Now, I think this is a shift more to the natural world, the living world that Job lives in. And so I think God sort of changes the focus to, does Job know something about lions and ravens and deer or goats? I mean, he lives with them. He knows something about them. So I think it's interesting how God starts off with these big concepts, and then he's going to move down into some things that Job is very, very familiar with. Things that Job lives with every day. And so this concept of the deer, do you know when the deer give birth? Do you know when they calve? in his area, there could have been a variety of deer, goats, antelope, things like that, that live over there. Today, there's a lot of ibex sheep over there. And these are animals that are really good at accessing rugged, steep terrain. And in some of these areas, these female ibex sheep, they'll go up into some of the most remote, rugged areas that you can find anywhere in that region, and they'll give birth up in those places because they're a bit safer. When you get up in those really rugged areas, it's a little bit safer from predators. It's also safer from people. And so it would be a very common thing for them, and it is quite a common thing for us today too, that when an animal like one of our deer or one of these ibex sheep or a goat, they're going to disappear into the natural world and give birth somewhere, and then they're going to reappear and come out into these more open areas where they're going to feed or find water or something like that. And so it's quite probable that in Job's life, he'll see goats or deer or sheep that are wild, and they disappear in the springtime, and they move up into these high reaches of the mountains. And when they reappear about midsummer, they have babies in tow. And he has no idea where they go and how they do this. And so God is just pointing this out. You know, this is something that's kind of mysterious in your world, Job, that you live with all the time. And it's something right in front of your face that you don't understand how it works. But I do. I made it. I made these things. And so God is going to continue to point out some subtle things about animals that Job probably, maybe or maybe not, he's thought about in his life. But the point is always going to be, this is an amazing thing about this animal, isn't it, Job? Guess what? I made it. That's always what the implication is going to be. So let's see. Let's keep going. What's the next? All right, let's skip down because the next section is about the donkey, but I want to read about the donkey and the horse sort of back to back. So let's turn down, let's look down at verse 9. And notice this passage that, notice this, these things that God says. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? Or will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in a furrow with ropes? Or will he harrow the valley after you? Will you trust him because his strength is great and leave your labor to him? Will you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it from your threshing floor? So now, does Job own oxen? If we look back at Job chapter 1 and we see a list of things, Job has oxen. But what's this animal? I know I threw a Cape Buffalo up on the screen, but God calls this a wild oxen. How many different types of cattle do we have on this planet? There's a lot. And there's a handful that we have domesticated, and there's a handful that we have not and never will domesticate. This animal right here is one in the oxen family, and we will never domesticate this animal. Do you know that that animal kills more people in Africa every year than lions? That animal right there is a beast. And they run people over, they trample them, they gore them, they're getting hunters when they're coming after them. This is an animal that describes perfectly what God is asking about. He's asking Job, and you can tell, the answer to most of God's questions are no, right? Like he says, will he spend the night at your manger? The obvious answer is no. This animal's not going to spend the night in your manger. You're not going to domesticate this animal and turn this animal into your pet. Now, why is that? Why can some of the oxen family be domesticated and then you have the wild oxen, no chance of domesticating this animal? That's strange, isn't it? Some are prone to it and some are not. And now Job owns some that are prone to it. And I wonder if he had ever thought, I wonder why I can domesticate these and I can't domesticate those. God is just pointing out an obvious fact that Job knows. But Job doesn't know why these two animals are this way. And God is sort of pointing out, it's a mystery to you, but it's not a mystery to me. I made them that way. Now, this is almost the epitome of that kind of concept too. Let's go up and look at verse 5. And we'll think about the donkey and the horse. Verse 5 says, who sent out the wild donkey free? And who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? To whom I gave the wilderness for a home, and the salt land for his dwelling place. He scorns the tumult of the city. The shouting of the driver he does not hear. He explores the mountains for his pastures and searches after every green thing. So look at some of the things that God points out about the donkey. Is the donkey a tough, rugged animal? Think about some of the places that God is describing that the donkey can move to and live. He's talking about, I gave the wilderness for his home. The salt land for his dwelling place. You know what a salt land is? I mean, that's a very desert type of a region. That is not a place where you're going to find a wide variety of life out there. There's not very many animals that really have the physical equipment to be able to live and sustain life out in a desert, in a salt land. And I could completely nerd out on you and talk to you about the livers of these things and all this stuff on how they can feed on some of the tough, rugged plant life that's out there, how they can operate for days without water, and then when they hit water, they take a lot in. I mean, a donkey is not a camel, and we understand camels are sort of legendary for that kind of behavior. But when you compare a donkey to a horse, a donkey has some of those camel-type qualities. And God is just pointing out, hey, notice what the donkey can do in these rugged, tough, wild places. And then notice what a donkey doesn't want anything to do with. You see in verse 7, it says, he scorns the tumult of the city. The shouting of the driver he does not hear. Now, I mean, this is, like, we understand this very well, don't we, about donkeys. You're going to grab a donkey and just jump on him and ride him around in a busy place. The tumult of the city just means the uproar and the noise and the commotion. You want to be on the back of a donkey when there's a bunch of commotion going on? No, because you're going to end up on the ground real quick, right? And so he just points this out. Hey, these donkeys can do some things, but there's some other things they have no tolerance for. They're not going to listen to you. They're not going to do what you want. They're not going to be in the commotion of that city. Now, let's drop down to verse 19 and compare the donkey to the horse. Because think about it for a second. A donkey and a horse. Are they closely related? Yeah, you can even breed the two species to produce mules. And so these animals, I mean, just look at them. They even look an awful lot alike. But boy, are they different, aren't they? Completely different. Listen to God's description of the horse. If you love horses, man, this is a spot to read right here. Verse 19. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrible. He paws the valley and rejoices in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed, and he does not turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the flashing spear, the javelin. With shaking and rage, he races over the ground, and he does not stand still at the voice of the trumpet. As often as the trumpet sounds, he says, "Ah," and he scents the battle from afar and the thunder of the captains and the war cry. How about that for a description of the horse? I mean, at that day and time, I mean, look at what these guys are using the horse for right now. At that day and time, horses were kind of the ultimate, weren't they? If you had horses, if you had a cavalry, if you had chariots, you had a massive military advantage in war back then at this time. And yet God sort of throws this out with Job and says, think about the donkey. Look at where he can live and look at what he will not tolerate. Look at the horse. The horse can't really live in some of those wild places like that. He's got to have a little different habitat. And yet look at his characteristics. Not only can he withstand the turmoil of the city, but when it comes to war, he just charges in. He is such an ally to you in your life. And yet the donkey is almost the opposite. And I think God is just pointing this out to Job. Look at these two animals that are so similar in their makeup, and yet they're so incredibly different in how they can function and operate in your world. You ever considered why that is, Job? Why can one animal do this and the other can do that? Again, God is just simply pointing out very quickly, it's because I made them this way. It's not for any other reason. It's not for, it's not conditioned response or evolutionary descent or anything like that. God is just simply saying, I made these animals this way. These animals are hardwired to be able to do certain things. You, Job, have no idea why or how that works. You just do know that it works, and I'm telling you that I'm responsible for it. That's what God's pointing out. Now, let's go to the next one right here. And this one in this chapter, it's probably my favorite. Notice this. I had to do this huge paper one time in college on the Rhea family and this these ratites and all the whole ostrich family. And so I learned a little bit about the ostrich. And we had not really understood ostrich biology until the 70s or 80s. In the 1960s in the United States here, we became well off enough and comfortable enough where we really started practicing conservation. And we really started, we had set bag limits and things like that for game species earlier than that. But we really started to study and practice conservation in the 60s. That's really when biology, as we know it today, wildlife biology, really started. And by the time we get to the 70s, we started almost having biologists in many parts of the world. And for the first time, we really studied the ostrich family closely. And we found out some really unique things about ostriches. And ostriches are they're a little bit like our turkey in some ways, in the way that you'll have one male ostrich, and he'll actually build a nest, and he'll attract, it could be one, two, or three females to him. And then they will lay eggs in this nest, and they may both, they may all work on the nest at some point a little bit, but those females will lay eggs there, and the two of them will take care of that a little bit together, but very quickly the female leaves. And it's the male that will continue to incubate, hatch those young, and raise those young and watch over them. And that is a pretty unique thing in the wildlife world. Most of the time, they'll do it together, or, most of the time in the bird world, it's the female that will end up laying eggs, taking care of babies for the most part. But with this family, it's kind of backwards. And, you know, why is that, Steve? I don't know. Why is the horse awesome and the donkey crazy? That's how God made them. And yet, what's interesting about this is how we have just really, that's pretty recent, have sort of figured this out and mapped out the biology of ostriches. And then I always like sharing this with kids too, because it always gets their attention. They always remember it. Have you ever seen an ostrich run? It is an impressive animal. This bird can hit 45 miles an hour and hold it for 15 minutes or more. That is incredible. They can top out around 50, 55. Can you imagine driving down the highway and looking over there? There's an ostrich coming by you. These things are fast. Their main mode of escape is obviously their legs. They get away from things. They don't stand and fight or anything like that. Boom! They just hit the afterburners. And when they're in full speed, their strides are equal to, if not a little bit greater, than our world record long jump. And I can't remember what our world record long jump is, like 24, 25 feet, something like that. It's higher than that. Long jump, 26, 29. Yeah, well, they're striding it out just about that much. You imagine this bird in full speed striding that. Almost 30 feet between strides. I mean, this bird can move it. And so it really is an impressive bird. So knowing this about its biology, how the males and females work and how this ostrich can move, I mean, just notice what God says about this bird. Verse 13, they start. Now, this first verse, too, most birds, you may know this about most birds because some birds are very famous for this. You know, like birds of paradise or things like that, where they're very flashy and they'll strut and they'll do crazy things with their plumage to attract females. Well, these guys have quite the dance, too. And, of course, maybe the most famous strutter is the peacock, huh? You know, we've all seen the peacock fan out. Then he gets that fan out, and then he shimmers it. And that, hey, for the peahens, they like that. They're like, ooh, look at the shimmer on that guy. I'm coming. Here I come. And then in our neck of the woods, we love to chase the wild turkey. They kind of do the same thing, you know. They puff up, and they strut, and they gobble, and they just carry on and make a crazy show of it. But ostriches, man, they really make a wild show. If you ever want to laugh, just, you know, go to YouTube and pull up an ostrich mating dance or a mating ritual. They'll almost lay down. They flap their wings out, and they start throwing their head all around. I mean, it looks like something's wrong with this bird. You think, something wrong with that bird. And they're just going crazy out there. But it's all it's a dance. It's a display. And that's just how God has set up the bird world, where they've got these colorful males that are attracting females typically. So in verse 13, God starts out and says to Job about the ostrich. The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love. For she abandons her eggs to the earth and warms them in the dust. And she forgets that a foot may crush them or a wild beast may trample them. She treats her young cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is unconcerned because God has made her forget wisdom and has not given her a share of understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she laughs at the horse and his rider. So you see, the first line talks about ostrich wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love, an obvious reference to their mating rituals and their mating behaviors. And the last line, she lifts herself on high and she laughs at the horse and her rider. A horse is going to top out at about 30 miles an hour. An ostrich can do that for 45 minutes. So to think that you're going to jump on a horse and catch an ostrich, the ostrich is laughing at you. Like, you got to be kidding me. That big thing is not going to catch me. And then that whole section in the middle really talks about how she treats her young, right? It's like, oh, she treats her young cruelly. She's forgot wisdom. Does she have motherly instincts? It appears that she doesn't, huh? She comes into that nest site, she deposits eggs, and she leaves. And it's the male that hatches and rears those young for the most part. What is that doing in the Bible? We did not understand this until recently. Is it something that Job could have observed? Yeah, it's possible. Why would they care who's rearing young and things like that? God is just placing things in this chapter right here that Job has probably seen, but he doesn't fully understand. And God is pointing out all these unique qualities of each one of these animals, whether it's the donkey and the horse, the ostrich, the wild ox. Very difficult for me to see how mankind at that time during BC times would have understood the biology of an ostrich. Let's keep going. Let's see now. We got to drop down to, this is the last one in this chapter, in verse 26. It says, is it by your understanding that the hawk soars, stretching his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the cliff he dwells and lodges, upon the rocky crag, an inaccessible place. From there he spies out food. His eyes see it from afar. His young ones also suck up blood. And where the slain are, there he is. Kind of gruesome, huh? What? The young ones suck up blood? Yeah. Slain ones? Now, where the slain ones, there they are. Everybody's going to know that, right? We all know vultures, buzzards, even some hawks or eagles, where you have a carcass, they're going to come in there and clean that up. But now, did you know that of all of wildlife, there's only a handful of animals, and it's mostly raptors and birds, that eat fresh flesh immediately out of the egg? Even crocodiles that you might think, hey, what about a crocodile? They turn to insects for quite some time before they start eating meaty muscle tissue. And you could go sharks and things like that. Yeah, they're going to go right straight for fish right off the bat. But of all these land creatures, hawks, eagles, things like that, they are literally eating blood immediately out of the egg. That's what the Bible says. How would Job know that? Especially given the fact that God points out where they typically nest. A rocky crag, an inaccessible place. So these birds are doing things up in these mountains, these cliff sides, these areas like that, that are very difficult to see into, be around. And yet God is sort of pointing out, here's how they live. Here's what they can do. And then, well, really, the first thing that he talks about is it by your understanding that the hawk soars, stretching out his wings toward the south? Do you understand how a hawk just opens up his wings and he's not flapping and yet he's gaining altitude? How do they do that? Well, we understand today that when the sun hits the ground, it creates warm thermals and it creates an updraft. It creates lift as air is warming, it's rising. And so a hawk just grabs warming air and just rides it up. That's what he does. That's why they make these big circles, and they're slowly corkscrewing and climbing up on these thermals. Can you imagine Job looking at that going, how's that hawk doing that? He's not flapping his wings. And yet he's... And I've watched so many birds just ride thermals almost out of sight. I'm sitting there watching them. Just can't hardly see them in just a matter of minutes. They're just little pin drops way up there in the sky. It's incredible to watch them do this. You think Job understands thermal lift and things like that? God just points it out. Hey, you know how that happens? No, you don't. I know how it happens. I made all these things. And then I think the most compelling part about what he's saying about the hawk is where he says in verse 29, it says he's up on a rocky crag, an inaccessible place. And he says, from there, he spies out his food. His eyes see it from afar. How would Job know what the eyesight is of a hawk or an eagle, something like that? Of course, we do these crazy elaborate tests and experiments today to try to figure out just exactly how good is the eyesight. We think that a bald eagle can read a newspaper at 1 mile just based on experimentations that we've done, trying to catch their attention with different experiments, different things. I mean, these are animals that just truly operate in this visual world, and that is their number one attribute. Yet, so put yourself in Job's shoes. Now, you see a hawk maybe fly into view, and then he comes over, wham, and he hits a ground squirrel right over here. You would tend to think, oh, that hawk just happened to be flying by, and then he hit the ground squirrel. When in actuality, he actually saw the ground squirrel 2 miles away. And he waited till the ground squirrel turned his back on him, and then he cruised over and got just in the right spot, boom, and he came down and hit him. How would Job have known that? Like, there's no way really to sort of visually, back in BC time, sort of spot something like a hawk 2 miles away and know that he's coming for that piece of prey right there. It's just an interesting thing that I'm not sure how Job could have figured that one out on his own. I think it's kind of a very important and unique fact that God just embeds right here in his description of the hawk or the eagle. So anyways, this turn over to Job chapter 40. Job and God continue their conversation here. So after all of this explanation about the natural world, from the foundations of the earth to rain and water to recesses of the deep to the stars, then he goes into all these different animals right here. Then the Lord said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. So God says, all right, after that beating, would you like to find fault with me? And in verse 3, Job says, then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add nothing more. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm and said, now gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you and you instruct me. Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Or do you have an arm like God? And can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, and clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Pour out the overflowings of your anger, and look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him, and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust together. Bind them in a hiding place. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. So God tells him, hey, your own right hand, it cannot save you. How can you judge me? How can you condemn me? And then the Lord keeps going. He says, behold now, behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold now, his strength is in his loins, his power in his muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. Under the lotus plant he lies down, in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. The lotus plant covers him with shade. The willow and the brook surround him. If the river rages, he is not alarmed. He is confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. Can anyone capture him when he is on watch? With barbs, can anyone pierce his nose? So that's quite a reading that God just points out of, hey, look at Behemoth. And then he gives all these physical attributes of the behemoth, doesn't he? And so for many years, many scholars have thought that the behemoth was a hippopotamus. And so is I like to sort of, okay, he eats grass. Now notice he said, God said he eats grass like an ox. So you think this is an ox? I don't think it's in the ox family, because God points out right off the bat. He eats grass like an ox. So he eats grass, strength in his loins. Okay, all right. Power's in his belly. Okay, maybe. His tail like a cedar. What? You got a funny looking little tail back there. I'm not sure it's moving around like a cedar. His sinews knit together. Bones are of bronze. That fits. Limbs of iron. First in the ways of God. Let the maker bring near his sword. I don't know. I just read that. I'm like, I think our thinking is always sort of stuck in the what we have on this planet now kind of a thing. He's not alarmed. Are you going to capture him? Are you going to pierce his nose? We don't have too many people capturing hippopotamuses still. No one wants to pierce their nose. Hippos kill a surprising number of people every year in Africa as well. I mean, this is a nasty animal. But just some of these things don't fit, do they? What about that? I threw that up there. I mean, is it possible that Job has seen this animal? Is it possible that, that tail's going to move around like a cedar. But I'm not sure that it fits all the other ones. Honestly, I've always thought, boy, that right there, that probably fits the descriptor more than anything else. Let his maker bring near his swords. I think got swords on his face. So I don't know. This is a mystery, and I hope he didn't show up today thinking Steve's going to tell us for sure what the behemoth and what the leviathan is. It's been a mystery for a long time. Nobody can figure it out. But it is fun to read this and to think about, what is this animal? What could it be? Why could it not be that animal? It certainly could be that animal. We consider that, it's a dinosaur. Yeah. Why couldn't God be talking about a dinosaur right here? I just think we have to try to open our minds a little bit to a variety of possibilities and not be stuck on, it's a hippo. What's the point of even bringing up the behemoth, though, for God? God describes this animal, and he describes the power that this animal has. And the point is, God says, you see that animal? It's pretty tough, huh? I made him. That's always the point. Now, I think we have just a couple more minutes left. Let's turn to the next chapter, and we'll read about the Leviathan. Now, you got to stick with me. This is a little bit of a lengthy reading. It's kind of interesting. Gil, will we go to 9:30, or should we stop just a few minutes prior?
We need to stop about 10 minutes short.
About 10 minutes short. Okay, we just got a couple. We just got about 1 minute then, it looks like. All right. Can you draw out the Leviathan with a fish hook? Press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will you make many supplications to you? Or will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him for a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you bind him for your maidens? With the traders bargain over him. Will they divide him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, your expectation is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he dares arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? That's right there the point of the chapter, isn't it, by the way? I get enamored with the animal part of it, but that is the point. No one is so fierce that he dares arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? Who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silent concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his orderly frame. Who can strip off his outer mail? Who can come within his double mail? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth there is terror. His strong scales are his pride, shut up with a tight seal. One who is so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezes flash forth light, and his eyes are like eyelids of mourning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of flame leap forth. Out of his nostrils smoke goes forth, and from a boiling pot and burning brush. His breath kindles coal, and a flame goes forth from his mouth. In his neck lodges strength, and dismay leaps before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together, firm on him and immovable. His heart is as hard as a stone, even as hard as a lower millstone. When he rises himself up, the mighty fear. Because of the crashing, they are bewildered. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw, bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned to stubble for him. Clubs are regarded as stubble. He laughs at the rattling of the javelin. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads out like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the depths boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a jar of ointment. Behind him makes a wake to shine. One would think the deep to be gray-haired. Nothing on earth is like him. One made with fear. He looks on everything that is high. He is king over the sons of pride. That is an impressive animal. I don't know what it is. I'm pretty sure it's not an alligator. I'm pretty sure it's not even a giant alligator. Again, I think we've got to think way outside the box here a little bit. I mean, that's a little closer. I mean, that is something that would send people fleeing for the hills. I don't know. I mean, there are dragon myths that are so old, and they come from all over the world. But there's what we saw him in Jurassic Park, Spinosaurus. I mean, that is a terrible, terrifying beast. Who knows? But I think it's definitely something that we do not have on this planet anymore. And people go, Steve, you're crazy. Dragons, come on. They can't breathe fire. I mean, think about some of the animals that we have on our planet and some of the crazy things they do. That guy makes his own light down at the depths of the ocean. This guy right here, blue ring octopus, he'll spit on you and it'll poison. It'll kill you. This guy, black mamba, yikes. The neurotoxin in them so powerful that his nickname's a three-step snake. You get bit, you got three steps. I mean, if that snake was extinct and then we told legends about the venom, people wouldn't believe that either. How could you have venom in your mouth? I mean, you know, poison dart frogs. I mean, we've got some insane animals around this planet. But of all the things that we've talked about so far, I like to just stack them up like this. And I like to think about them in this terms right here. Not any one thing is just going to convince you, oh yeah, that's what the Bible is. But when you start stacking everything up, it's pretty hard to ignore, isn't it? Anyways, we'll take off right here a little bit later this morning, and we'll take a look at Genesis chapter 1. Thank you.